From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, Spike Lee's BlacKkKlansman opened on the one-year anniversary of the riot in Charlottesville and includes actual footage of the violence. Then Kerry Brownstein co-created and starred in Portlandia with Fred Armisen. Now she has an Emmy nomination for directing.
I always wanted to make things that felt more pointed or trenchant and satirical, and Fred, I think, was more interested in things that were absurd, and somewhere in the middle was Portlandia.
And we meet a queer singer-songwriter with a new take on bro country anthems. All that coming right up.
KPCC podcast supported by National Geographic's Genius Picasso, starring Antonio Banderas in the Emmy-nominated role as the 20th century's most influential painter. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including Outstanding Limited Series. natgeotv.com/FYC. And the HBO series Barry. NPR claims it's the best new comedy on television. For your Emmy consideration, nominated for 13 Emmys, including Outstanding Comedy Series.
Welcome to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for joining us. Spike Lee's movie BlacKkKlansman premiered this weekend to strong reviews and the best opening box office numbers of any Spike Lee movie in 12 years. The film's release was timed to the one-year anniversary of the violent white nationalist rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, in which one peaceful counter-protester, Heather Heyer, was run over by a car and killed. The movie is set in 1970s Colorado and is based on the real-life true story of Ron Stallworth, a black police detective who infiltrated the local chapter of the Ku Klux Klan. While there are a few funny moments in the film, it also includes a sobering modern-day epilogue with actual footage from Charlottesville and clips of President Trump saying of the white supremacist rally that ended with the killing of Heather Heyer that there were, quote, very fine people on both sides. I recently spoke with Ron Stallworth and John David Washington, the actor who plays him, about BlacKkKlansman, and I asked them if they thought the film would have been received differently if it had come out just a couple of years earlier. Here's Ron Stallworth.
It could not have been made at any other time except this one. If it had been made 2 years, 3 years earlier, it wouldn't have the impact that it's having right now in the public mind, because Duke wanted to achieve high political office, and he wanted to do that from the standpoint of promoting his Klan ideology. Well, he didn't do it. He got as high as the Louisiana House of Representatives. But he tried to, he ran for vice president once and president once. David Duke wanted to be where Donald Trump is, and so the movie is very, very contemporary, even though it is events that took place in the past.
John David, the film and the book also talk a lot about the 1915 movie Birth of a Nation. It's used basically for Klan movie night, and it really espouses a point of view that the Klan finds really attractive. And it made me think a little bit about how movies shape culture and views about race and how they kind of solidify and codify those ideas. And I'm wondering if you think, A, that's true, and B, if movies today can be corrective in some way about addressing issues of perception and bigotry.
Movies have sort of these points of views, and they like Spike Lee, for sure, have been doing it for decades, been able to sort of celebrate, you know, certain men and women of cultures that are not white and celebrate their differences and celebrate the different colors of personalities and through the neighborhoods, and he's been doing it for decades. So I definitely feel like it can be inspirational sometimes when you see, and unfortunately, Birth of a Nation was too for certain people that believe in that sort of thing. So we got to be very responsible with our art, you know, and know that you know, this is for the people, and the people can sort of take from it what they want. And it can be, like you said, corrective in a way, too. It could be a lesson. This film doesn't seem to me to be suggestive, though. It doesn't. There's lessons in it. There's messages, very strong messages in it. But the package and delivery of those messages are in an entertainment form are very, like, detailed in the way that only Spike could do it, which I'm very proud of. And I love when films do that. They're not just hitting you over the head with a listen, and you should listen up to this, or you should be taking this in. I don't, as an audience member, necessarily want to be told what to believe, whether that be the bad guy or the good guy. You know, I want to decipher that for myself and the people in the audience as well. And this film, to me, just lays out what happened, as the book does.
Spike, in my opinion, was at the top of his game in making this movie. And saying that, I want to point out that, to me, Malcolm X was the best movie he ever made. I love Malcolm X. But I think he surpassed himself in putting this movie together.
Wow.
Because he was able to weave the historical thread between the Confederacy to Charlottesville to David Duke to Donald Trump. And I think Spike is a master at doing what he does. And in this case, I think he surpassed his own mastery.
John David, I think you know one of the actors in Malcolm X, don't you?
Well, I think we all do. I mean, we all saw it. Well, I shouldn't assume we all saw it, but yeah, no, I know. I know him a little bit.
I want to ask you both a little bit about the coda on this film. There's footage from Charlottesville and some other things that happened more recently. I understand there was some debate about whether or not that was the proper way to end the film. Should it be in? Should it be out? How would you say that you each reacted to the film when you saw it with the coda?
I thought it was unbeknownst to me. I didn't know it was going to be in there. And it shows that, yeah, again, like it was an entertaining movie, but let's not lose focus on what's going on and what we're talking about. Like it's happening still. It's happening in a new package, in a new delivery, a new face. And in this information world too, we sort of developed this ADD where there's so much happening, we're almost becoming, you know, impervious to this sort of bad news. But we shouldn't, you know, we can't make this regular. We can't say, oh well, what's next on the circuit? You know, we got to remember these things, and we got to, you know, deal with these issues.
Ron, what about you? What about the coda?
I sat in the theater mesmerized the first time. I've seen the movie 3 times now. The first time I was mesmerized in the last 5 to 10 minutes when you're getting all this coming at you. I think Spike was very gutsy going to Heather Heyer's mother and asking her permission.
That was noble.
Heather, we should say, was a peaceful protester who was run over by a car at Charlottesville and killed.
And I wish I could see her so that I could thank her for giving him permission.
Yeah, same here.
Because that culminates and polishes off. That's the exclamation point on that whole movie, when you see her daughter murdered as violently as it was, and when you see all that action unfolding. That woman is, as far as I'm concerned, she's a saint.
That was Ron Stallworth, the author of the memoir Black Klansman, along with John David Washington, who plays Stallworth in the film version of the book. It's in theaters now. Coming up, Kerry Brownstein, who co-created and co-starred in Portlandia, is one of the very few women who has an Emmy nomination for directing.
KPCC podcasts are supported by National Geographic's Jane, a film by Brett Morgan and the most Emmy-nominated documentary of the year, called one of the best documentaries of all time by Vogue. The film profiles legendary conservationist Jane Goodall and was created from over 100 hours of never-before-seen silent archival footage. Nominated for 7 Emmys, including exceptional merit in documentary filmmaking. Visit natgotv.com/FYC for more information.
And the HBO drama Game of Thrones. Time calls it the biggest and most popular show in the world. In the epic season 7 of this colossal hit, the people of Westeros fight for their seat on the Iron Throne. Winter is here, and beyond the Great Wall that protects them, a forgotten evil has returned. The most Emmy-nominated program this year is nominated for 22 Emmys, including Outstanding Drama Series.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. In 2010, the cable channel IFC premiered Portlandia, a sketch comedy show co-created by and starring Kerry Brownstein and Fred Armisen. After 8 seasons, the series went off the air earlier this year. Now it has an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Variety Sketch Series, and Brownstein is nominated as well for directing an episode. When I sat down with Brownstein, she reflected on what made this show work.
One reason it worked is because I always wanted to make things that felt more, you know, pointed or trenchant and satirical. And Fred, I think, was more interested in things that were absurd. And somewhere in the middle was Portlandia.
How did you find that space if you are... If you and Fred are coming at it from slightly different perspectives and you're working with a lot of collaborators and writers and different directors, how do you find the place that everybody agrees is the right solution and not a compromise?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of it is trusting the process. Part of it is knowing that through collaboration, you will arrive at a place that is unexpected. And you have to believe that arriving at a place you didn't think you would arrive at is actually better than what you predicted. And if we all have faith in that process, that there is something unknown about it, and trusting, you know, that the free fall and sort of landing in a way that's graceful, then you just, you can go forward and not feel like a compromise. And I think we just believed in each other enough and believed in the structure and what we created enough to know that this could be a surprise, but it will probably be better than what we originally had in mind.
One of the things that you have on a series like that is like basically whenever you're in production, you have a family reunion mm-hmm. and you go away and you all come back together. And now you're not going to have the family reunion, which has to be a little bit sad. What do you think you're going to miss most about not coming back together and not working on the series?
I was just talking to one of our writers, Graham Wagner, about this, because the thing we took for granted the most was that once a year when, you know, the 6 to 8 writers got together, we were able to process phenomena via one another, via these conversations about politics, about relationships, about culture. And it was cathartic. I mean, it was hard work, but there was a catharsis in knowing that we could read the newspaper or witness something or experience something personally and go into this room and be able to kind of, you know, it was almost a form of detox, you know, to just be able to kind of process this. And there have been so many things, whether it's just in the news or out in the world, that I miss sort of having this, you know, group of people to discuss this with or to make fun of it with, in terms of like making fun of myself or just saying, ugh, you know, how is this happening? How can we process this? And I don't have it. So that I think I miss the most, you know, just reading the news and not being able to go and kind of talk about it for 3 hours with other people.
I want to ask you about the episode that you're nominated for an Emmy for. It's called Riot Spray. It's the name of a punk band that Fred's character reconvenes. And if you know anything about music, you would recognize the musicians in it, probably most prominently Henry Rollins from Black Flag, who's the lead singer. The guys show up, but it's clear they're not quite the punk rockers they used to be. Let's listen to a little bit of a scene from Riot Spray.
Oh my God, lobotomy patients for Reagan. And his eyes are hexed out. They were brainless.
Check out this old sticker.
I love the Dallas Cowboys.
I'm going to go to the Super Bowl and have a beer.
You know what's changed in the Super Bowl? Like in the last 10 years or so, the halftime show is like really watchable.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, it's kind of unbelievable what they get done.
Did you see Bruno Mars?
Bruno Mars, that's what I'm talking
about. He's incredible.
About.
Bruno Mars, the pop star.
He can really play drums.
He does it all, right?
I mean, the idea that these guys respect Bruno Mars is just terrifying to Fred's character. But it's also about something that you come back to repeatedly in Portlandia, and that's this whole idea of growing older.
Yeah, so a lot of our characters, I think, you know, like their ideals and idealism were always like running up against these obstacles. And, you know, a lot of the obstacles were just the younger self and these kinds of, you know, whether it was being anti-corporate or being anti-capitalist, or just, you know, living a certain way and then realizing, wait, can I still live that old way and take care of my family? You know, how does that make them feel when they realize, when they look in the mirror and they see, you know, a person they never thought they'd turn into? Like, I'd rather figure out the who of it. And that then you're leading with compassion, I think.
Right.
Then you're leading with, like, oh, it's instead of poking fun at someone.
You do poke fun, though, and there's a sequence in this episode about podcasters As someone who works in radio, it's so spot on, it's terrifying. The podcasters are embedded in a small police station.
I close my eyes and try to imagine growing up in a place like this, living with the feeling that I'll never be able to leave.
Hicks, you want me to get rid of these guys? This is a closed briefing, there's no press.
No, they're good. We had the option between body cameras and podcasters. I went with the podcasters. My kids love them.
I'm Darren Blum.
And I'm Dana Blue.
And this is Forgotten America, Rural Footprints.
Pretty good little tune right there.
Couple things we have to describe. The band that you're hearing is traveling with them. They're playing live, and sometimes they miss their cues. This is, I mean, Forgotten America, Rural Footprints sounds like a real podcast. So there's such an element of like reality to that which you are satirizing. How did this story come about? Because I think it's very emblematic of the kinds of things you like to do.
Yeah, well, obviously we'd all been listening to Serial, and specifically it was S-Town, I think, had just come out. And, you know, we were just talking about the ways that sometimes, not always, but some true crime podcasts kind of fetishize, you know, the rural, the other, you know, they sort of exoticize small town America in a way that can be kind of, it's condescending, but also just, you know, it's flummoxing in some ways. I think we kind of came at it from that angle and then just dove into it with the band that was along for the ride. And this crime was completely, I mean, it was tragic, but ordinary, and just trying to sort of create a story out of nothing. And so then our podcasters went in there, yeah.
And they actually end up planting evidence or something at the crime scene just to make the story better.
Yeah.
We're talking with Carrie Brownstein about Portlandia. I want to ask you about the Emmys. You are nominated this year for directing for variety series. I think you're the only woman in the category. You're also the only director who directed him or herself and created the series that you're nominated for.
Yes.
I mean, it's probably gratifying, but is it a little odd that you are in some ways an outlier?
Well, you know, I just don't think progress is inevitable. I think that's just, you know, that's just not how things work. And it is frustrating, of course, to feel like an anomaly or to look at the landscape and know that there are more women who are directing and writing and not seeing them recognized. But, you know, we just implicitly have so many biases, and we have, you know, so that, and we have been, there's so much systemic inequality that just because we have sort of an awareness that it exists doesn't necessarily mean that things will change overnight. We're still dealing with structures of patriarchy and capitalism. And, you know, we can't just sort of assume that with, you know, talking about it is going to bring about change in this way that's sort of linear and accumulative. So I think it's just the work is not done, you know. The work is probably never done. I mean, if history has taught us anything, it is a constant dedication to progress and change and, you know, learning. Hopefully it will be different next year. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to be nominated, and I wish there were more women along with me.
I would say that there are so many iterations of the characters that you have played in Portlandia who'd be mortified by the idea of competing for an award. But as a storyteller and a creator and a director and a writer and an actor, it probably means something more to you. How would you define what awards mean as a creative person?
I think so much of what we do as not just artists or creators, but as human beings is the desire to be seen and to be heard. And not all of us do that on a big scale. Some of us are struggling every day to be seen or heard by the people we love or by our communities, by our cities, you know? And so for me, awards or nominations, it's just about being seen and being heard by a group of people who I really respect. And I think that it's also just about connecting with people and just feeling like I'm being acknowledged for making that connection. So it does mean a lot.
Carrie, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Carrie Brownstein co-created and co-starred in Portlandia, which has an Emmy nomination for Outstanding Variety Sketch Series. She is also nominated for directing an episode of the series. Coming up, singer-songwriter Sam Buck and his boyfriend played to country music audiences in the South. We hear why the reception surprised them. Now, singer-songwriter Sam Buck has been described as the gay king of bro country. Inspired by Nashville recordings from the 1990s, he tells queer coming-of-age stories that range from introspective to bawdy. The LA-based musician and painter just released his self-produced EP, Borderline. Buck also frequently hosts an LGBTQ-friendly country review and line dance in central LA. But like many do-it-yourself musicians, he makes his living through non-musical means. Frame producer Jonathan Shiflett recently spoke with Buck, who is joined by his collaborator and boyfriend, Sam Zimmon.
I'm Sam Buck, and I'm a musician.
I'm also Sam. I'm the boyfriend. I'm in the band.
I feel like style-wise, I always say, like, we're more like Walmart parking lot than we are Rhinestone Cowboy or something, yeah. You know? Face it, in this town, there's
only basics, hands to the wall. And I think there is a certain level of drag that goes into what we do a little bit.
I like to play with having a masculine look and sort of a more feminine stage presence. So now every
man wants me, but I have no interest in the men.
Typically the setup of our show is me almost like a DJ with a microphone and Sam with a guitar.
I don't think it makes sense, but yeah. It makes sense to us. And when I started like wearing a cowboy hat on stage, it made more sense to people that they could identify it as country. We were on tour recently in Texas, and we're used to playing in LA, and you know, we're from the Northeast. Like, a lot of our friends couldn't even really tell that we were playing country. The reaction would sometimes be, oh, I can't really hear how it's country, but
I like it.
Then when we got to Texas, people were like, sounds like Shania meets Arthur Russell or something, yeah. You know? No one's gonna love you like you love yourself. I was nervous about playing in like Alabama and Texas. You know, I felt like as a gay couple, like we sort of would come out every night on stage. Like, I feel like we got more love from those audiences because they were compensating for like perceived bigotry. We got a lot of love for being gay.
It's like you know? Sort of a boost to our...
You know, because we've been together for almost 10 years.
Almost 10 years, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm going to mention that. I want some claps. Here I go. Send me to where I don't
care or no. Playing music and just sort of getting started at this point, it doesn't pay any bills.
I myself clean apartments right now, which is something I've done for the last 10 years off and on.
Yeah, this place, I was honestly just here a few days ago because it's an Airbnb.
I find it rewarding. It's meditative. I mean, it can also be torture, obviously.
You don't want to surprise people with the fact that you're like a 6-foot-tall man when you come to clean their house. So I put on my Craigslist ad, like I made my headline, Friendly Gay Guy Cleaning Service. And I immediately got a response from a guy who runs a gay guy cleaning service. So like, I didn't get clients that way, but now I work for this guy who runs a cleaning service of
just gay guys, which I don't really get the appeal, but at the same time, like, sure. When I was 12, I chose that I was just gonna be a musician, and that was sort of like a declaration. Turned around, I never would have stopped. You know, I used to put on shows in my hometown, and I always loved like making flyers, putting them up, making my CD artwork. I just love the process, and it just comes naturally to me. So the Country Review is a show I do, and the concept is I put together a band and we back up different singers. It's like a fast-paced variety show. We got some choreography in there. It's a pretty queer expression of country, yeah. But that's just based on who we are, I guess, you know?
I will see people there at the Review and they're fully like dressed up in country drag with a bolo tie and a cowboy hat, and they're singing along to some of these songs. So I think that for some people, it is really exciting to come to this event, like, that they never thought would happen with this sort of scene of, like, queer art people in LA.
I don't feel like I'm playing with country. I feel like it really did choose me and that I like feel very committed to it. We're married.
What, you and country?
Yeah. Till death do us part. Just because they're bad men doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah. I find no comfort. And that is all for today. Make sure you follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. We'll see you back here tomorrow.